Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right, from the Tokyo Weekender, we have the news that Japanese scientists have developed artificial blood compatible with all blood types.
Oh.
Sweet.
Oh, yeah. And we need blood to play a vital role in saving lives around the globe every day. So the challenge comes in maintaining an adequate blood supply. And that's especially the case for low and middle income countries, especially when it comes to the demand for O negative blood. This is the universal donor type. And the donations also have a limited shelf life because human blood, kind of perishable, right? Mm-hmm. So looking to address the issue are a group of Japanese scientists led by Hiromi Sakai at Nara Medical University. And yeah, they have developed a new type of artificial blood that can be used in patients of any blood type. This is a big, big deal. Now, how they created it is by extracting hemoglobin from expired donor blood. It is then encased in a protective shell to create stable, virus-free artificial blood cells. These artificial cells have no blood type, so there's no need for compatibility testing, which is a nice way to shave off some overhead as well. And it can reportedly be stored for up to 2 years at room temperature.
Whoa. Wow.
And 5 years under refrigeration.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that is a significant improvement over donated red blood cells, which right now can only be stored under refrigeration for a maximum of 42 days.
Wow. I didn't know it was that perishable.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder, like, I've never thought of this before, but can you give a vampire food poisoning?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I know it's not culturally relevant anymore, but this is literally the plot of True Blood, including that the Japanese invented it.
It literally is. And that's what got me so hype about this, because if you go to the True Blood fandom wiki,
right?
True Blood is a brand of synthetic bottled blood engineered by Japanese scientists.
Yep.
This is what made vampires come out of the closet, so to speak, as a plot point. Because when you have, you know, they don't have to kill people anymore. So if the scientists end up creating a Yakonomo Corporation, yeah, we're in that timeline. So just look out for that name. But until then, we're still just looking at the science that has made this incredible achievement. Now, they started these small-scale studies in 2022. They had three groups of four healthy male volunteers from ages 20 to 50, and they got a single IV injection of hemoglobin vesicles in increasing amounts, up to 100 milliliters. And while some participants had mild side effects, there were no significant changes in vital signs, including blood pressure. So, building on that success, they announced the team was accelerating the process, and in March, it started administering between 100 and 400 milliliters of the artificial blood cell solution to volunteers. So, it's out there, y'all.
Wow.
Just jumping right in.
And, like, do you know you're getting it? Like, I guess if you're a volunteer, well, you've said you'll take it.
That's exactly it. So, they're hoping that if they can confirm no side effects, which is looking promising, it aims to put the artificial red blood cells into practical use by around 2030. So, that gives you time to sharpen stakes and build the bunker and all of that.
Right, just in case.
So, just in case, because, you know, to your earlier question, in True Blood, if you did follow along with later seasons, they did have a virus that specifically attacks vampires, which they called Hepatitis V. It's probably worth a rewatch because, boy, that was a fun show.
Yeah. I have an anecdote that is only slightly related, but it was really fascinating to me. One of my dogs recently had to have a blood transfusion. And the specialty vet was telling me about, oh, actually, dog blood types are completely different from human blood types. And in fact, there's a lot of them. And she said about 50% of dogs have like the most common easy type. And if you're outside that 50%, they don't even try to match it. They just only go with the universal type because it's far too hard to find the exact type, which was all cool and everything. But I was like, well, so you don't know which one my dog is yet. And she's like, no, we'll find out. But if we don't have any universal blood here and that's what he needs, I have a dog at home that is a universal donor, so I'll just bring my pet in. Oh. I was like, what? Your poor dog is just this, you know, blood boy for all of your patients. I don't know. I felt very, very bad, but fortunately it was fine. But
or that dog chose that vet because the dog wanted to be of service and knew that by hooking up with a vet, they would be able to save a lot of doggy lives.
That's right.
Saying.
He was volunteering too. Volunteerism
you
runs
know?
In all species.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from ArsTechnica.com. It's titled, Cambridge Mapping Project Solves a Medieval Murder.
Oh.
Ooh.
So in 2019, Ars Technica talked about a new interactive digital murder map of London compiled by University of Cambridge criminologist Manuel Eisner. And you can just go to the site. So if you're interested, it's medievalmurdermap.co.uk. And let me tell you, they were doing a lot of murder.
There wasn't much else to do around then, right?
Yeah. I mean, got to keep yourself occupied somehow. They have an entire legend showing what sorts of weapons were used, like sword, long knife, short knife, poleaxe, pike staff, hands, bone arrow. So yeah, if you're interested in that, you should take a look. But today we're focusing on a specific killing. You can think of it as kind of 14th century version of Clue. It was the noblewoman's hired assassins armed with daggers in the streets of Cheapside near St. Paul's Cathedral.
Which it should be noted, they call it Cluedo. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, Cluedo.
Well, we call it Clue. They literally call the game Cluedo, which I don't understand. I don't know why they call it that, but they do. Anyway.
Yeah, they do things different over there.
Including murder.
Yeah. So that's just the juiciest of the various cases described in a new paper published in the journal Criminal Law Forum. The noblewoman was Ella Fitzpaine, wife of a knight named Sir Robert Fitzpaine, Lord of Stogersey. The victim was a priest and her erstwhile lover, John Ford, who was stabbed to death in the streets of Cheapside on May 3rd, 1337. Ford was walking on the street when another priest, Haskup Neville, caught up to him, ostensibly for a casual chat, just after Vespers but before sunset. As they approached Foster Lane, Neville's four co-conspirators attacked: Ella Fitzpaine's brother, two of her former servants, and a man called John of Tyndale. One of them cut Ford's throat with a 12-inch dagger, while two others stabbed him in the stomach with long fighting knives.
Ooh.
At the inquest, the jury identified the assassins, but that didn't result in justice. Eisner says, a household of the highest nobility, and apparently no one knows where they are to bring them to trial. This was typical of the class-based justice of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Colne, the former servant, was eventually charged and imprisoned for the crime some 5 years later in 1342, but the other perpetrators essentially got away with it. Eisner et al. Uncovered additional historical records that shed more light on the ensuing feud between the Fitzpaines and Ford. One was an indictment in the calendar of patent rolls of Edward III, detailing how Ella and her husband Ford and several other accomplices raided a Benedictine priory in 1321. Among other crimes, the intruders broke the prior's houses, took away a horse, a colt, and a boar, felled his trees, dug in his quarry, and carried away the stone and trees.
That's time-consuming. You go chop down his trees?
Oh.
Like, that's an entire project.
Yeah, that's like salt the earth, but being extremely thorough.
Mm. Yeah. The gang also stole 18 oxen, 30 pigs, and about 200 sheep and lambs.
Wow.
There were also letters that the Archbishop of Canterbury wrote to the Bishop of Winchester, calling out Ella by name for her many sins, including adultery with knights and others, single and married, and even with clerics and holy orders, and devised a punishment. This included not wearing any gold, pearls, or precious stones, and giving money to the poor and to monasteries, plus a dash of public humiliation. Mm. Ella was ordered to perform a walk of shame, a tamer version than Cersei's walk in Game of Thrones, every fall for 7 years.
Carrying... So not tamer, because consecutive. Good God.
Yeah. Ella outright refused to do any of that, instead flaunting, quote, her usual insolence. Naturally, the archbishop had no choice but to excommunicate her. But Eisner speculates that this may have festered within Ella over the ensuing years, thereby sparking her desire for vengeance on Ford, who may have confessed to his affair with Ella to avoid being prosecuted for the 1321 raid. The archbishop died in 1333, 4 years before Ford's murder, so Ella was clearly a formidable person with the patience and discipline to serve her revenge dish cold. Her marriage to Robert, her second husband, endured despite her seemingly constant infidelity, and she inherited his property when he died in 1354. Eisner says, attempts to publicly humiliate Ella Fitzpaine may have been part of a political game, as the church used morality to stamp its authority on the nobility, with John Ford caught between masters. Mm-hmm. Taken together, these records suggest a tale of shakedowns, sex, and vengeance that exposed tensions between the church and England's elites, culminating in a mafia-style assassination of a fallen man of God by a gang of medieval hitmen. And yeah, I'd watch that true crime.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that different than what's happening now, though?
Well, it's a lot less sheep involved. I mean,
that's true.
So if you're interested in checking out that medieval murder map and speculating about some of them yourself.
Or if you're even a psychic medium, because imagine the potential of leading people on walking tours and.
Right? Yeah, I tell you, West Chep Street is like Stabbing Avenue. There's a lot going on there.
There's not much walking. You're just like, okay, take another step. Now we're at the next site.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, next up, we've got a little explainer from SciShow called Einstein Didn't Want People to Study His Brain.
Oh.
Aww.
So, as you may or may not know, when Einstein died in 1955 from a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, the pathologist who did his autopsy removed and preserved his brain for science, and it has since become the most studied brain in history. And before we get into what they have and have not learned from this, it's important to note that Einstein absolutely did not give his permission for his brain to be donated to science. His wishes were to be cremated, and the rest of his body was, but only after the attending pathologist removed Einstein's brain and saved it of his own accord. Which, that's ballsy.
Ballsy, it's non-consensual. Like, explicitly non-consensual.
Yeah, it sounds like a party foul to me.
And of course, when one of Einstein's sons discovered this fact, he was understandably furious. But eventually, the doctor did convince the family to sign a consent form for studies to be performed. The thing is, even though they went through all that drama and subterfuge to get his brain, the first study on it wasn't published until 1985, a full 30 years after his death.
Jeez.
And we'll get to why that is in a minute. But the important thing, or so they thought at the time, was that this 1985 study did show that Einstein's brain had some unusual anomalies, which is what everyone wanted to hear, right? We want to believe there's a clear reason as to why this man was such a genius. So, sure enough, the 1985 study claimed that Einstein had a much higher ratio of glia to neurons in the inferior parietal lobe. Now, there are several different kinds of glia, but generally speaking, they are support cells for the neurons that are doing the actual work. So they hold neurons in place, they form the protective coating that allows messages to travel more quickly, and they bring nutrients to the individual neurons as well. And when they compared the number of Einstein's glial cells to those of 11 controls, they found that the controls had about one glia for every two neurons, while Einstein's ratio was nearly 1-to-1. That being said, we now know that there were some problems with this finding. First of all, the control brains in this study were all patients who had died at a VA hospital, meaning all of them had done some amount of military service. And while we've never specifically identified a connection between glial cells and PTSD, we do know that military service can affect the brain in some really significant ways. What's more, the study was very quiet about the fact that the inferior parietal lobe was not the only part of the brain they looked at, and glial cells were not the only type of cell. And in every other instance, looking at a total of 28 combinations of cell types and locations, the only difference they found between Einstein and the controls was specifically the glial cells in this one specific lobe. Long story short, they've since done a lot of other studies on parietal lobe glial cells across the population, and scientists now think that a 1-to-1 ratio is actually the norm. So then a second study in 1996 looked at a slice of Einstein's right prefrontal cortex. And this is a part of the brain that's involved in things like emotional regulation, understanding other people's state of mind, and planning out actions for the future. And they found that while Einstein's prefrontal cortex had a normal number of neurons, it was a little thinner than average, meaning the neurons were packed more densely.
Mm.
So the researchers at that time theorized that maybe this meant messages in Einstein's brain could travel faster, and that's why he was smarter. But subsequent studies have found no correlation between denser prefrontal neurons and intelligence. What they do show a correlation with is schizophrenia. Mm. So maybe that was in the mix. Who knows? So in 1999, some researchers said, okay, you know what? We need to stop looking at these microscopic slices and instead look at the overall shape and size of his brain. Lo and behold, they found what they were looking for, which was that Einstein's inferior parietal lobule was slightly larger than average, and his supramarginal gyrus did not have a typical groove running through it.
Hmm.
But other researchers looked at the same pictures and said, no, you're being ridiculous. Lots of people have those features. And in fact, we think this brain is so completely normal, it belongs in a textbook next to the word brain.
Not the Abbey, but the normal.
Right. So then the scientists on the his brain is different team claimed that it looked like there might be a slight knob on his right precentral gyrus, while the opposition said, no, that knob is normal for people with a lot of musical training, and Einstein was an accomplished violinist. Another study looked at Einstein's corpus callosum, which is the connecting pathway between the left and right hemispheres of the brain, and they again found that his was a little bigger. And there is indeed a correlation between a thicker corpus callosum and a higher performance on IQ tests, but it wasn't that much bigger, at least not to a degree that would explain his having so much more intelligence than your average pretty smart person.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of other studies, but at the end of the day, none of them were blind, meaning the researchers always knew when they were looking at Einstein's brain, you know, it's like the holy grail in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, they also backtracked themselves into a hypothesis where they found something in his physiology that they thought might be different. And then they combed through his life looking for evidence that it had had some outward effect. And they got real nitpicky on it. They were like, oh, look at the motor section. And here's this one diary entry where he talked about his leg twitching. And it's like, okay.
It's like the natural result of the Western naturalist mind that seeks to know by dividing. And it's so funny because what you mentioned about the part of his brain responsible for like emotional stuff, he was famous for being a very spiritual guy. Like he has quotes talking about like spiritual revelation is often the first step in any kind of scientific discovery. And he developed a lot of like academic work on consciousness and things like that. So it just tickles me endlessly that hard science is really going to just stay in its hard science lane.
Right. The owner of the brain was not on that train. But
yeah. Like if you actually listen to the guy you believe is like the world's greatest genius, maybe you might learn something.
No, no. Right. He wasn't smart in that way. Smart in ways that we will know by looking at his meat.
And I mean, not to get on too big of a soapbox right now, but like this is a constant thing throughout intellectual history with materialist science. Like we love Socrates and Plato and all that. We're just not going to talk about all the other spooky stuff they thought because they were actually dumb in those specific things.
Well, and of course, there's still that initial 30-year delay we talked about, which happened because the pathologist who first stole his brain was especially obsessed with it. And he basically ran study after study on it by himself for the next 30 years, none of which were ever publishable because none of them found any difference. Like the one guy who was more determined than anyone to find anything couldn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if you really want to know who's smart, you can probably just have a conversation with him and get an idea. Like, well, I don't know that we need physical proof of why it happened.
I love that. One guy, like a total fetishist who could not divorce himself from the idea that the secret of smarts lay in this direction, dedicated 30 years of his life to it, after which everybody else was like, nah, you're probably doing it wrong. We'll take over from here.
Right. And in 1985, they're like, we have better science now. We're going to try
it. We're going to read his journals.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, from noridge.com, scientists have developed a mosquito-specific STD.
Oh.
And it's working!
Oh, okay, that's good.
I mean, all right, I don't think this mosquitoes appreciate it, but that's fine.
No. And if you are a science fiction writer, you will probably really enjoy this because the new method uses a fungus. It's called Metarhizium, and it has long been used to control pests in agriculture. But in this case, scientists genetically modified the fungus so that it produces a mosquito-killing toxin. When male mosquitoes are sprayed with fungal spores, they become carriers, but they're not harmed. Instead, when they mate with female mosquitoes, that's when the real trouble begins. So it's only the female mosquitoes that bite humans and spread diseases like malaria. And once a female mosquito is infected, the fungus enters her body and kills within about 2 weeks. So the results that they have done from early trials in Burkina Faso, West Africa, they're pretty promising. So areas where male mosquitoes were sprayed with the modified fungus, about 90% of the female mosquitoes died after mating.
Wow.
And most importantly, at least from what we know so far, this fungus is harmless to humans.
We hope.
We hope. Other insects, other animals, really looking to find out. Now, this approach could not come at a better time. Malaria is still killing over 600,000 people every year. And this is mostly young children in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, in recent years, malaria control has become even more difficult because mosquitoes, well, they've adapted to avoid chemical sprays and insecticide-treated bed nets. Dr. Raymond St. Leger, the senior scientist behind the study, is quoted as saying, "This is really an arms race between us and mosquitoes. We need to stay one step ahead of them by using their own biology against them."
Yeah, I mean, the females could definitely evolve a resistance to the fungus just from an immune standpoint. But like you said, it's an endless arms race. So that's fine. Yeah. This will work for now. And we'll come up with something more deadly.
Right. Yeah, a nice super punch of like multiple fungi who can then develop their own sentient intelligence, because we've definitely talked about that before. We also found that the male mosquitoes remained infectious for up to 24 hours after being treated, which means they could theoretically spread the fungus through several mating sessions. And
I didn't know mosquitoes were such players. Like, you know, that's a lot of
they
mating.
They got a short lifespan, so everything is on a real sped up timeline for them, right?
Right.
But even better, the fungus weakened the mosquitoes' resistance to insecticides. So our standard treatments are getting a boost from this fungal assassin, basically.
I mean, unless they invent tiny little mosquito condoms, you know, but otherwise.
Thank God that sex education amongst flies is not very good.
Right. Very, very poor.
Right. Next link.
Next link. We're going to stay in the realm of little flying things with this article from PopSci.com titled "Researchers Genetically Altered Fruit Flies to Crave Cocaine."
Why do they have to alter them for that? Cocaine's amazing. No, I'm kidding. I don't know.
Yeah, believe it or not, they don't have good taste, so they don't cocaine.
They just don't like starting bands, I guess.
Yeah. Coming up with business ideas at 5 in the morning, yeah. So yeah, as strange as it sounds, there are potentially life-saving reasons for genetically altering the insects to crave the drug. The novel biological model could help addiction treatment therapies develop and expedite research timelines. The findings are detailed in the Journal of Neuroscience. Researchers have relied on the insects for genetic studies for years, but there's always been a small problem. Flies don't like cocaine one bit. That's Adrian Rothenfla, the study's senior author and an associate professor of psychiatry. Even when previously introduced to cocaine, the insects routinely opted for pure sugar water over sugar water laced with cocaine.
I mean, same. Like, I like sugar better than cocaine, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have Red Bull, right?
That's real. And also, why would you drink water with cocaine in it? Like, it's not how that works. So, study first author Travis Filia theorized the reason may reside in a fly's sense of taste that is found on their legs. Filia explained, "Insects are evolutionarily primed to avoid plant toxins, and cocaine is a plant toxin. They have taste receptors on their arms, their tarsal segments, so they can put their hand in something before it goes in their mouth and decide, I'm not going to touch that."
Huh.
After confirming that cocaine activates a fruit fly's bitter-sensing taste receptors, Rothenfla and Filia switched off those nerves. Once deactivated, there was little to stop the flies from developing a cocaine habit.
Nice.
Rothenfla said, "At low doses, they start running around just like people. At very high..."
He sounds like he knows.
Yeah. And at higher doses, they start actively trading on the stock market.
Yeah. And he says, "At very high doses, they get incapacitated, which is also true in people." Now that researchers know how to breed the modified fruit flies, they can more easily study how cocaine addiction evolves in the body. Not only that, but they can do so on a much faster timeline by analyzing hundreds of genes at a time. Filia said, "We can scale research so quickly in flies. We can identify risk genes that might be difficult to uncover in more complex organisms, and then we pass that information to researchers who work with mammalian models."
Yeah, I mean, snip the genes out. I mean, I'm sure there's other gentler ways to do it, but if we got CRISPR now, if we can find genes that make you susceptible to cocaine addiction and we could just snip all that out, that's awesome.
Yeah, but isn't there more money in making sure you activate it in really subtle ways?
Right, or you just have to keep taking the drug that makes you not crave it every day, forever.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if they had that for sugar, I would take it.
Yeah, why aren't we looking at sugar addiction separate from cocaine addiction? These flies seem very addicted to sugar, so.
True. They have a problem.
They have a sugar problem. Get over it, hummingbirds.
Next link.
Next link.
This is from SciTech Daily. MIT has discovered a magnetic superconductor in pencil lead.
What?
Huh.
Oh, yeah. It's just as mind-blowing as you think. And I can barely follow this, so I'm going to do my best. But MIT scientists have identified a bizarre new material. It is a superconductor that also acts like a magnet, which was something thought to be impossible until now.
Hmm.
Even more surprising, the researchers found this exotic behavior in the familiar substance we know as graphite, the same material we use in pencil lead. So graphite is made up of countless layers of graphene. And graphene is a one-atom thick sheet of carbon atoms arranged in a honeycomb pattern. Now, normally, we stack these layers very neatly on top of each other, and that is what makes them easily flake off whenever pressure is applied. Think about writing on a piece of paper, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes, tiny pockets form where the stacking is slightly skewed. Now, these MIT scientists discovered that when just 4 or 5 layers are arranged in this special rhombohedral pattern, the material behaves in an entirely new way. So their new study, they isolated microscopic flakes of rhombohedral graphene from graphite, and they subjected the flakes to a battery of electrical tests. That's the word they use. So they found that when the flakes are cooled to about 300 millikelvins, which is about -273 Celsius, the material turns into a superconductor, meaning any electrical current passing through the material flows through without resistance. And they also found that when they swept an external magnet field up and down, the flakes could be switched between 2 different superconducting states. This kind of switching behavior, you don't see that in other superconductors. Because the general lore is that superconductors do not like magnetic fields. These scientists had no reason to question these assumptions. They carried out their experiments, they applied a magnet to the material along with a voltage and measured the electrical current coming out of the material. And as they dialed the magnetic field from negative to positive and back again, what they saw was the material maintained its superconducting zero resistance state, except in 2 instances, once at either magnetic polarity. So in these instances, the resistance would briefly spike, but then immediately switch back to zero and return to a superconducting state. So if this were a conventional superconductor, it would just remain at zero resistance until the magnetic field reached a critical point, at which point it just kills the superconductivity. But instead, this material seems to switch between 2 superconducting states, like a magnet that starts out pointing upward and then flips downwards when you apply a magnetic field, right? You can kind of push a magnet around using those forces. So it looks like this is a superconductor that also acts like a magnet. And this is a quote, which doesn't make any sense. I love it when scientists get to a point where they're like, this is breaking everything we know, because that's what science does at its best, right?
Well, and it's pretty amazing as well that, like, you know, superconductors are generally expensive and hard to locate. And it would be awesome if we've just discovered pencil lead. Like, it's so much more abundant and easy than some of the other substances we're currently building superconductors out of.
Right.
And I have a giant collection of old school pencils in my house that I'm happy to sell. So, like,
or reconfigure in some some way to make your own superconductor if we figure out how?
Yeah, there's got to be videos on YouTube, little how-to explainers on make your own superconductor with pencils. Yeah.
Your challenge as a DIY scientist in this field is going to be getting that unique configuration of rhombohedral graphene just right. That apparently is the key.
Admittedly, I'm going to have a hard time getting to negative 273 Celsius.
Yeah.
So
well,
maybe I should leave it to the scientists.
Or, but, you know, today you are, but who knows what the next ice age is going to present as far as opportunities. I'm trying to look at the bright side here. Next link?
Next link.
This article comes to us from TheGuardian.com, and it's titled Contraception Warning Over Weight Loss Drugs After Dozens of Pregnancies.
Oh, is this Ozempic? Because I've been waiting.
Is.
I've been waiting for the thing. Because there's not any miracles, y'all. There aren't. And I'm, okay, good. I'm not going to be joyous. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, babies are miracles, right, baby?
Are you, sure, yeah.
In the proper context, I suppose. Women using weight loss drugs have been urged to use effective contraception after dozens have reported becoming pregnant while taking the medication. Ozempic and Wegovy, which both contain semaglutide, work by mimicking a hormone called GLP-1 that triggers an increase in the production of insulin, slows the rate at which food is digested in the stomach, and reduces appetite. Mounjaro, which contains the active ingredient tirzepatide, also acts on a second hormone involved in appetite and blood sugar control. Although these have been referred to as weight loss injections, not all are authorized for weight loss. The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, has said Mounjaro may reduce the effectiveness of oral contraceptives, such as the pill, in people who are overweight, and that women taking the medication should use barrier contraceptives such as condoms. Last year, The Guardian reported that the popularity of weight loss drugs had resulted in an unexpected baby boom. The Facebook group I Got Pregnant on Ozempic had more than 750 members at the time.
Wow.
Yeah. The MHRA said there had been 8 reports relating to pregnancy in those taking semaglutide and 9 reports for liraglutide, which is found in another weight loss drug, Saxenda. The watchdog also said these drugs must not be taken during pregnancy, while trying to get pregnant, or while breastfeeding, as there was not enough safety data to know whether taking the medicine could cause harm to the baby. In some instances, women should continue using contraception for up to 2 months between stopping the medicine and trying to get pregnant. Dr. Channa Jayasena, a consultant in reproductive endocrinology and andrology at Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust, said, "We think that the absorption of oral contraceptive pills may be reduced with GLP-1 drugs, which slowed down the emptying of the stomach, though more research is needed to confirm this." Dr. Allison Cave, the MHRA's chief safety officer, said, "Skinny jabs are medicines licensed to treat specific medical conditions and should not be used as aesthetic or cosmetic treatments. They are not a quick fix to lose weight and have not been assessed to be safe when used in this way." And like, yeah, we know that, but does anybody care? No.
Honestly, I appreciate the bluntness of the British system where they're like, yeah, we're going to call this a skinny jab because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. That's what people are using it for. And I'm not trying to gloat over people whose lives have now been dramatically changed or may have health problems because of it. It's just there's always a problem with the magic pill that makes you skinny. Mm-hmm. There always is. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, Although, if you think about it, this is basically the opposite of what we're doing to the mosquitoes. Like, we're taking a drug that makes us all pregnant. And then... Anyway.
Yeah, I'd prefer the cocaine needle, personally, but...
Right. If you got to pick one.
That is not how you do cocaine, nor should you. That is not an endorsement.
No,
it's
you need to put it in the synthetic blood, and that's how you really get the cocaine.
There you go.
Universal cocaine donor.
I'm ready. We got to brand it everything.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Shipwreck Mystery Solved After Nearly 140 Years, How World War II Changed How France Eats, and, quote, I Do Not Remember My Life and It's Fine. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.